And I'm really amazed by what founders are able to do by building businesses that reset entire industries. I think wherever you're too comfortable for too long, it's a problem. Like, I would make for a terrible entrepreneur. Especially like on the professional service side, like consulting. I think over a certain number of years, it starts becoming, it degrades your ability to do something entrepreneurial.
When you see founders walk through the door, what is it about the ones that you're like, yeah, I'm going to fund you?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great, great question. The attributes of the most successful founders I've seen in the region are, if you build a good business, there's always capital available, always.
Hello, and welcome to Lucidity Insights podcast, The Perfect Pitch. And it's my pleasure today to welcome our guest, Khalid Talhouni, who's the managing partner of Nua Capital. Khalid, nice to have you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, as I was researching for this chat today, something struck me. Well, first of all, that you're a Jordanian. You mm-hmm. were born and raised there.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yep.
And you had mentioned somewhere that you were a Marxist leading...
I knew this was going to come back at some point.
Yeah. High schooler. And I'm super curious, how does a kid who would self-describe themselves as a Marxist end up as... Well, end up at Duke studying economics, because that was right after, and then end up being a venture capitalist with capitalist in your, in your title.
Yeah, I think so. Like, just for the record, no longer a Marxist. Like, I haven't been for a long time. Like you said, I think the job description is a dead giveaway. So, I mean, without going too, becoming too kind of philosophically inclined, but I think the, you know, at the edges of that type of ideological spectrum, you know, far to the right or far to the left, they sort of meet. They sort of meet in that sense of radicalism. So when I was younger, I think I was very attracted to that idea of radical solutions to kind of big problems, basically. Mm-hmm. So on the left wing of the spectrum, the idea is, you know, there are certain inequities in society, especially in somewhere like Jordan, which has like these kind of extreme inequalities that manifest not just in income and economic inequality, but also there's kind of this vast cultural rift in society, which, you know, growing up there, I really felt, you know, I was lucky enough to grow up in a very privileged family. And I was hyper aware of that because I felt, you know, a little bit alienated from the rest of, you know, outside of our little social circle, 1% or whatever, I felt very alienated from the rest of society. I became hyper conscious of it. And that kind of drew me to, you know, a very kind of Marxist way of looking at the world, like the alienation of the wealth from those that create the wealth in a way. So, so that drew me to that. But the intention was, how do you think about solving for that inequality? But more importantly, how do you make people's lives better off just generally, right? Like, how do you make it better for the vast majority of society? And as I moved from Jordan to university in the US, and I was exposed to kind of, let's say kind of like much more academic thinking on the left, but also in my main degree, which is in economics, you could see that the Marxist arguments were abstracted. They were not rooted in any kind of reality. But the economics arguments in terms of like how the free market or capitalism, as it were, or the idea of enterprise, free enterprise, can help lift so many people out of poverty. And I think the story of the 20th century is the triumph of the latter half of the 20th century is really the story of the triumph of the free market and capitalism over to bring millions of people, almost like a couple of billion people, out of poverty, especially in places like China, even in our part of the world, in the Middle East, in Latin America. I mean, it's just such a revolutionary moment. So in that sense, to tie it back, you know, that idea of individualism, the free market and free enterprise is radical in its ability to kind of transform people's lives for the better. So I kind of shifted there, and in some goes some way to explain why, like, I have the word, you know, capitalist in my job description, even though that I think is more a happy coincidence in a way. But it explains why I was drawn to that idea of, like, working with entrepreneurs and founders and build and helping to contribute to build businesses.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by that, because even the 17-year-old Khaled, you said, was intrigued by radical solutions to solving big ideas or big problems. And in some extent, that's what venture capital say that they do with money.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we don't do the solutions.
Yeah.
You know, we're one step removed. We invest in the founders that are building kind of radical, outlandish, out there solutions, right?
You still have that angle.
Yeah.
There's a...
Yeah. I think that's kind of foundational in my personality. You know, I'm quite mild-mannered, but, like, I think I believe in, like, radical shifts and radical changes, and I'm really amazed by what founders are able to do by building businesses that reset entire industries or social constructs or ways of interaction for the better, more efficiently, more effectively, and most importantly, profitably.
Mm.
So that's kind of what draws me to this industry, really. And like I said, like, us as VCs, we don't really do it. We sort of are the midwives to work on producing good companies, but it's the founders who are the ones actually doing the work, right? Like, we're actually doing it.
Yeah. They're the ones that are in the maternity ward.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you're holding their hands.
Exactly. Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, very interesting. And so from Duke, was it capitalism that drew you to Dubai?
No, it's need of a job, basically. So I graduated and I from Duke in 07, sorry, graduated from high school in 2003. Not to prematurely age myself, but I was thinking of going to law school, and I wanted to take a year or two off to kind of figure out what to do in between. I have an uncle here. He graciously offered to let me kind of crash on his couch for a few weeks. A few weeks turned to a few months, and then from there, like, I sort of landed this very strange... Actually, it was tough finding a job. It was very tough then, because I was very unclear as to what I wanted to do. But then I met... somebody introduced me to somebody who... at a private equity firm that doesn't exist anymore. It was part of Dubai Holding, called Dubai International Capital. Mm. They famously invested in, like, Madame Tussauds and stuff like that. They want to set up a seed fund, which would have been the region's first seed fund.
Mm.
And the purpose of the fund was to build an angel network of angel investors to invest in entrepreneurs and founders. It was not very tech focused. It was just, like, entrepreneurship generally.
Okay.
I think the idea had a lot of foresight. There were only two people there. It was myself and Waleed Hanna, who became the founder of MVP.
Oh,
and that was
wow.
His first foray also into into, like, anything, you know, VC or entrepreneurial related. And then I've been in this kind of ecosystem ever since. So that's law school in the end.
You got plugged into VC, like, right away. And this has been your entire career.
Basically, whether that's good or bad, I mean, time will tell. But I think the first 6-7 years, it was a mixture of, like, VC, private equity, a bit of other things, because there wasn't that much around here, really, at the time. I mean, just in terms of classic tech VC, the internet penetration, high speed internet penetration, just wasn't there between 2005, 2008, 2009. It starts changing.
2010.
Yeah, that's when you have very rapid, exponential, widespread mobile-based high-speed internet penetration, really around like 2009, 2010, very quick, very rapid. And then suddenly millions of people come online very suddenly, and they want services, and they want, you know, they want to interact online. And suddenly the couple of years after that, that's when you start having interesting companies emerging.
Interesting. So I'm curious, you started out your career with Waleed Hanna, who is one of the big and, you know, longtime OGs, you could call him, in the Dubai investment landscape. And you also ended up working for a famous Jordanian entrepreneur, Fadi Gandour.
Yes,
At Wamda Capital later on. I'm curious what you learned from each of them.
So with Waleed Hanna, I think, you know, so he was my first boss, really. But it was, again, just the two of us for the longest time. Eventually, Amir Farha joined, so which makes for an initial interesting initial cabal of like people interested in the ecosystem. But you know, I learned from Waleed the importance of, I mean, he's not that much older than me, but I did learn from his experience around the importance of persistence and the ability to kind of be razor focused on a goal. So I think that was super important. I didn't work with him that long, so it was only like, I think, a year and a half, if memory serves. From Fadi, obviously, I worked for a long time and I learned a lot, and I'm very extremely grateful for that experience with him. I think that it coincides also with the growth of the ecosystem. So when we kind of set up the Wamda Fund, was also, you know, beginning 2013, if I'm not mistaken. That also coincides nicely with the acceleration of the landscape overall and the formation of interesting companies. And, you know, it went from being this sort of kind of, I would call it like cottage industry, like this kind of like very niche thing, to becoming very mainstream very quickly by the time we raised the fund. So we started late 2013. I think we raised the fund in the first close by 2015. And by then you had, you know, real businesses emerge. So from Fadi, I mean, to answer your question, from Fadi, I learned, I think his enduring quality, which I've always deeply admired, is the unending sense of optimism. Mm-hmm. I think that's super important, like optimism in what the future may bring. And I think, and I wonder if he'd articulated that way or not, I'm not sure, but I think that's an incredibly important way of conceptualizing the world and seeing how things can in a trajectory be positive. And I think that's super important. Everything else, I mean, there's a lot of, like, he has a lot of great qualities, but I think that's always been the thing that's drawn me to him, and I really enjoyed when I worked with him, was that kind of sense of optimism for the future.
I love that highlight, because as I think, you know, about the founders that I know here and also the successful founders across Silicon Valley and you know, out west, the most prolific ones are, they do have that sense. It's almost uncanny.
It's really important. I think because if you're pessimistic, or if you have a tinge of cynicism rather than pessimism, I think it's hard to kind of push forward on your idea and your business, because the odds are stacked against you. Actually, like, you know, just probabilistically, business was if you're going to look at it purely rationally, your business is going to most likely going to fail. It's going to be very difficult while you build that business. That's probably going to fail. So unless you have an innate sense of positivity, it's very hard to kind of wake up in the morning. I mean, to Fadi, I mean, he always tells a story, if I remember, where when he was building Aramex, you know, there were many days when he would like just not want to do it. And he was just like, you know, I've got creditors, I've got, you know, whatever, like angry clients. I can't remember the details, you'd have to ask him. But it was that just perseverance and the belief in that things will lead to something positive in the end is what gets you through it. And I think that's such a critical personality component in a great founder. You know, so that's
And tell me, you've spent, I don't know how many years it is, it's been like over 15 years you've been sort of in the venture capital space.
Would be 17 this year.
17 years. I would think, yeah, optimism, or so this there's some kind of special sauce energy of great founders. Tell me more about that. When you see founders walk through the door, what is it about the ones that you're like, yeah, I'm going to fund you?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, because I think spend a lot of time, especially when we look at like seed stage investing, early stage investing, the founder is the core founder, or founders are the core variable. They're everything else, the idea, the product, you know, the unit economics, it's all marginal. It's really, because there's not that much there with respect to all that other stuff, but it's really, you just have a team, like, or a person or a group of people who have set themselves on solving for a big problem. And it's not like it's a matrix really of kind of ideas or components that lead in my view, like, to a high probability or higher probability of success. And it's not that kind of straightforward. And I've always been thinking, like, we should write it down. There are a few things. I would say, we said, you know, optimism, that kind of positivity, I think, super important. Number two, it's balancing a clarity and focus of vision, meaning being, you know, saying, I believe that this is the solution to this problem and I believe in that vision. And balancing that with the ability to take in feedback and respond effectively. So not being intransigent, being able to kind of like evolve. But if you're too reactive to what others say and to the market, then, you know, you'll lose your focus and your vision. So the great founders, and I know this is like difficult to kind of articulate, the great founders are ones that clearly are able to kind of balance the externalities, and then couple that with their kind of focus on what they want to do and incorporate effectively. I think that's super important. Number three is being able to attract people around them and sell them on a vision. Some people call that culture building. I think that's the essence of like building culture, is being able to attract and motivate great people around that idea. And different people do it in very different ways. I don't think there is a secret sauce to that kind of culture solution, but especially the early founders are the ones that are able to kind of sell a vision, almost cult-like, right, in some respect, right? And that they're almost like, you know, you're asking the people with you, knowing that most likely the company is going to fail, right? Like, if you think of it rationally, company is going to fail, like, yeah, just like put in the probabilities, 98, 97%, whatever it is not going to work. But you're asking the people around you, who have the kind of the management team around you, to have this kind of suspension of disbelief, to kind of go on this journey with you. And that's a skill. I don't know if it's learnable. It's a personality trait, and being able to do that is super important. So that's kind of like high level, I think, traits. In terms of specifics, I would say the attributes of the most successful founders I've seen in the region are, they tend to have a bit more humility. So if you look at founders of Karim Mudassar and Magnus, extremely humble people. You see, look at Samih Tukhan, Sam Khoury, founders of Maktoub and Souq, along with Ronaldo. Very, very, like, there's a lot of humility there. You look at Abdulaziz Lughani from Flower, extremely, like, there's an extreme humility there, and an understanding, I think, that it was a combination of luck and hard work and perseverance that kind of got me here. So that's kind of important. But drilling down into kind of more, you know, career-driven attributes or profiles, so they tend not to be straight out of college. And there are outliers to this, so let me like just kind of caveat by saying there are all kinds of outliers. They tend to be mid-career professionals. They are not the 22-year-old or 21-year-old college dropout. We don't tend to have those so much. And I think if you look, benchmark globally, don't have a lot of those, even though there are famous examples, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, et cetera. But I think regionally,
it's a very American and West Coast phenomenon.
But even there, I don't think I think the vast majority of successful founders actually don't look like that.
It's true.
Those are just kind of like really,
and they're super outliers.
Yeah,
like they were so peculiar.
Exactly. Yeah. So Steve Jobs, like, famously, we create this archetype around a few outliers, as we tend to in kind of mythologizing anything. But with these guys, but actually, the bulk of people don't look like that. They tend to be mid-career professionals, you know, late 20s, to 40 in that range, they tend to be, it's not like a rags to riches story. It tends to be like people who are, you know, upper middle class, have had great education, particularly university education somewhere else, at good universities, so top tier kind of universities that lead them to kind of blue chip experiences, whether in consulting firms or multinationals or something like that. And then, but have not spent too much time there.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really important not to, especially like on the professional service side, like consulting. I think over a certain number of years, it starts becoming, it degrades your ability to do something entrepreneurial. So hence the age. So that's when it starts.
I heard you say that last weekend, and I have a strategy consulting background, and I wondered about that. But actually, even my CEO and I, when we were recruiting for different offices across Asia, we would not hire other consultants that have been at big firms more than 2 or 3 years.
Yeah,
they were just less moldable.
Yeah,
and we did have a more of a, you know, an entrepreneurial type consulting outfit where we were growing small teams. And yeah, so that's quite interesting.
Yeah, I think the consult, I mean, I don't want to, because like I have a lot of friends in management consulting, and I do think there's a lot of valuable skills and a way of critical thinking that is taught. I never worked somewhere like that, but I can see people coming out of it. And so they learn this kind of, you know, a way of thinking and a way of, conceptualizing the world and deconstructing problems and, you know, creating solutions, which is great. I think that's super useful. It's a very elastic way of thinking of the world. So you can put a manager consultant, anything, solve this problem, and they'll deconstruct it in a great way. I think the issue is when you're there too long, and I don't know what the cutoff, I joke, it's like 5 years, 7 years, I don't know, something like that. But I don't know what
I'm sure people are like, oh my God, I've got to submit my resignation soon.
I don't know what that... I don't know what that number is, but there is a point where you move from, you know, it's great in critical thinking to actually it goes into the realm of cynicism, in the sense that because you're just kind of producing a 200 slide deck and divorced from the implementation or the realities of operations, you start to kind of, I'm making kind of sweeping generalizations here, but you start, I think a lot start becoming divorced from the problem. It just becomes an abstract intellectual problem with no idea of
it's
how
a bit
to
too cerebral.
Yeah. And it becomes cerebral for cerebral stake. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's no longer, it doesn't matter if it works or it doesn't. And you have no stake in it. You have no, it's a classic principal agent problem. You're divorced from the outcomes, but then, because you do that like 10 times a year, it stops mattering and you start thinking of the world through that prism. So there is a cutoff at some point, I think.
I
to become an entrepreneur, I mean.
To become, because there's risk and all of the, there's a set of skills required to really step into that. But I would argue also if you're in cushy government jobs or even in, you know, Fortune 500 companies, if you're not someone that's moving around, taking on new, really exciting, very different dynamic roles, that you're also sort of dulling your potential to be able to be a successful.
Yeah, 100%. I think wherever you're too comfortable for too long, it's a problem. Like, I would make for a terrible entrepreneur now, because I am quite comfortable because I've done this for so long. The most I've been out there is like trying to create newer, like build something.
Yeah.
But it's still far removed from like a founder with like operations. They've got 200 people reporting to you. It's a different thing.
Level of stress.
So I don't know if it's stress or just so many operating variables, right? Mm-hmm. Rather than, you know, contained. So same with government job, blue chip kind of big corporate job. You're there too long, then it's a problem. I mean, there are, and again, I think not everyone is suited to be a founder, and that doesn't mean like that's not a value judgment. Like, some people can be great corporate executives, great strategy consultants, management consultants, or we mythologize the founder a lot, but I mean, it's not for everyone. It's good, bad. Like, it's not, we shouldn't think of it in those terms, right?
Yeah, I remember at business school, it sort of felt like a sausage making factory for entrepreneurs. You know, everyone was like, I just want to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And I thought that was very strange. And I was very anti-entrepreneur at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And or I was just anti the culture of
which business
people.
School? Because not many of them like to produce that.
I don't know. I should say Stanford.
Ah, okay. That is the quintessential entrepreneurship school. Okay.
But I remember being there going, some people are just here to be an entrepreneur without really knowing what that entails.
Yeah.
And yeah, yeah. You know, a lot of business schools, it's not just Stanford. I have friends who went to MIT and other places. But, you know, they have this notion that they're building the world's leaders. And I really question that. I think they're building the world's tech ecosystem leaders to some extent. But if you look at the rest, the whole world and the GDP, you know, economies that actually are lifting people out of poverty, tech is a very small component of that. There are entire economies that need to be in place before we can be talking about, you know, AI and some of these other things that
but
need to be built on top of that.
I think that the thing to think about technology is not, so if you isolate the tech sector generally, and you look at its contribution to global GDP, particularly in emerging markets, but just anywhere, that went from very niche to kind of much bigger chunk of the overall kind of economic mix quickly. In pure tech, what we would consider like a tech firm, so like what's listed on the NASDAQ or what's in the kind of tech index.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the real impact of technology on economic development kind of long run is this kind of incredible deflationary quality, whether it's, you know, SaaS or cloud computing or AI, which is it allows you to do your whatever your business is or whatever kind of economic activity you're involved in in a much more and exponentially increasing efficient way and more productive way. And that's the impact of technology, really.
Absolutely.
So, and that's kind of like an abstraction of its contribution to GDP in a way.
Yeah. And from that light, I see it as, and I'm not bashing tech here, more and more embedded into the tech ecosystem and super passionate about the innovation aspect and all of this. But there seems to be this grandeur of a lot of people in the tech ecosystem saying we're changing the world without acknowledging that they are standing on the shoulders of giants that have built these economies that need, you know, these entire businesses that are unsexy that need to exist for them to embed their tech on top of that.
I think like there's one thing is to consider, and we think about this a lot, is this kind of demarcation of tech, non-tech. So technology businesses, quote unquote, versus, you know, real world or non-technology businesses. I think outside of what you would consider deep tech, quantum computing, some climate tech that's, you know, fusion energy, stuff like that, AI or like not AI applications, but actually like, you know, development of AI. I think this demarcation's false in a way because, like, you know, let's take regional companies or global companies like Careem, Uber, etc. Is that a technology company really? I mean, it's leveraging technology to solve for like a taxi problem, basically.
Mm.
And it's a new type of business model. So the power of Uber, Careem, you know, that type of business is really how do you increase rapidly the supply of, you know, taxi drivers using technology.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the technology deployed is not that, you know, it's not, you know, it's easily built. It's, I say that now, but like it's still, I mean, with all respect to the developers who built those businesses, but, you know, it's the power of it is how it used technology to develop a new business model rather than technology driving the business model, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can replicate that across the board. I mean, e-commerce, Amazon, it's just about retail, right? Like, how do you take the original model of retail was one to many, right? Many people go to a storefront, right? That was the premise of retail for thousands of years, right? And technology allowed you to kind of go to from the one to the many,
mm-hmm.
right? That's the power of it. It's kind of reshaping a business model. So I think like so much of the world is going of the economic order in the next 10, 20 years, as has been the past 10, 20 years, will be increasingly upended because technology is going to reshape existing industries.
Mm-hmm.
And for us in the region, we don't do deep tech generally. I mean, maybe that's
yet.
There's whatever reason, like, we don't do that. But we're really in the realm of, you know, tech leveraged businesses, tech enabled businesses, mm-hmm. to reshaping industry. So that's, I think, what matters. But I think on your point, I mean, not to ramble on too much, but I think human beings love mythologizing, like, you know, big characters, whether that's the founder, you know, in the 80s, it was the investment banker. In the 80s, 90s, really was the investment banker, right? You know, so you can take any point of history and, like, you know, like, pull out and say, what's sexy, what's cool. Yeah, exactly.
What's hot right now?
Yeah, well, everyone wants to be X, right? Yeah. Like, everyone would be an astronaut in the 70s. Like, yeah. It's just, I'm assuming, you know, like, it's...
And maybe now, who knows, maybe, I don't know, what's the new group, Gen Z? Maybe they don't want to be founders. Maybe they want to be YouTubers.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. I mean, basically, content creators. Everyone wants to kind of tell their story, their narrative, you know. And again, technology enables that, right?
Yeah, and democratizes it.
Exactly. Everyone wants to tell their story in the 1950s, but you couldn't, right? It was very hard to get to kind of like the...
Yeah.
To get to the...
Poets had to, like, leave little sheets of paper in their cupboards, which would only be found years later, you know, after their death.
Exactly, yeah. But, I mean, basically. So I think you could pull that out from any time. So,
So tell me about your sort of entrepreneurial last venture, which is you setting up Nua Capital. Tell me a little bit about... Well, first of all, I want to know, what's the decision that went into, okay, I'm going to leave WAMDA, which is a pretty... big, you know, and you obviously had a great relationship with Fadi. What's the thought that goes, or the impetus of, I want to start my own fund?
I did feel like WAMDA was, in a sense, like mine, but not mine, right? But I did feel like a very big sense of ownership. Fadi helped me, kind of really helped me enable that feeling. Like, he felt like it's yours if you want it. But I think, like, it was time to kind of author my own story along with my kind of partners in crime. So, like, Sara, Stephanie, eventually Nitin, Erna, Victor. So we want all these people to kind of, we were all kind of joined by WAMDA, but we wanted to kind of build something that we could author. There is something, you know, to that feeling of wanting to kind of step out and do something on your own. That was it. And I think
what would you say you do differently
from
WAMDA?
It's a good question. I think we do a lot of things quite similarly. I think what we're trying to do differently is really look at different parts of the entrepreneurial journey and then build funds or products or ways of investing for each. We're not there yet, but we're trying to kind of do that. The second is, and we haven't figured it out yet, if I'm honest, is productizing value creation or support for founders. So Nitin, for example, really focuses on that and figuring out how do we actually drive good value to the founders in an operational sense. That's kind of like a new thing. Thirdly, we're very focused on, I think, different, and this is a function of a different era, is, you know, Saudi Arabia is emerging as like a core geography, and we're much more focused on that relative, you know, we were involved at the time, but that was a function also of time, really. And that.
Tell me a little bit more about that first point. You said, you know, trying to raise funds to specific stages of entrepreneurial growth.
Yeah.
So it's not about the stage of the company. It's something else you're thinking.
Yeah. So I think eventually we raised the $100 million seed fund, originally it wasn't a seed fund, actually. Originally it was a Series A, like a multi-stage fund. So, I mean, we came out and started fundraising in about mid-2020.
Hello, COVID.
Yeah, that was not fun. But it worked out in the end. We raised, took a while, but we raised it in the end. And the original idea was we're going to do seed, Series A, Series B. You know, even if you look at our constitutional documents, they say Series A, Series B. And then... during the latter half of COVID, I would say, you know, ZIRP environment, valuations going through the roof, like, it was just nuts. And we said, this is crazy. So we shifted that whole fund to look at early stage, seed, pre-seed, mm-hmm. pre-A. So ticket sizes were smaller because the thought process was, we should take systemic risk, meaning taking risk on the early stage, rather than take valuation risk. Because right. you could end up in a scenario where, for example, you invest in great companies, you make the right selection, you get the founders to choose to work with you, the right founders, and you invest. But because you've entered at, I don't know, let's say, for example, $100, $200 million valuation, $80 million, $60 million valuation, it's a good outcome, it's an exit, but you're not making the type of return because the valuations shrunk later. And valuations are cyclical by nature. And it felt like that delta between what the entry valuation was then versus what the potential exit is if it reverts back to a 10-year mean was huge. So you end up, we invested in a great company, we came in at like $100 million valuation, but then, you know, it'll raise another 2-3 rounds, but then we'll end up exiting at 200. You know, the problem there is we'd have been diluted by like 30-40%, and we would have made like 1.2x, 1.3x. That's the good outcome, you know, in a portfolio where you're going to lose 50, 60, 70%.
Where you're wanting all of your founder or all of your portfolio companies to return at least 3-4x.
Exactly, exactly. That was the worry. So we said, okay, how do we solve for this problem? Go early, way earlier. And even if the valuations there are higher, so if the difference between a $10 million valuation and a $20 million or $25 million valuation, there's still so much delta. So even if you're compressed later, you know, instead of making, you know, 5x, you make 3x once the valuation is compressed. But portfolio-wise, should work. Obviously, the counter-argument to that is you're taking early risk. So risk of failure is much higher than like one or two rounds later. So that's what we kind of balanced, and we decided to shift the fund there. So that's kind of early fund. We want to do, I mean, we're not kind of ready to really talk about because we're still kind of putting them together, but like want to build like families of funds targeting different stages, so later stage, etc. But also like different types of funding. And then
sectors.
Whether that's sector or, you know, debt versus equity. We also want to do stuff like sector as well, like you said, like that's one area, and kind of innovative forms of financing. But I think our core focus now is like this kind of early fund and then kind of build out from there. So that's okay. You know, the building of Nua, the vision is not to be a VC per se, actually, in an odd way. Mm-hmm. I think it's more to be an investment platform for innovation in emerging markets, primarily around MENA to start, but then to grow. And that can take different forms. So not just, you know, investing in kind of early stage startups, it could take different kind of attributes. Mm. That's a long-term 20-year vision
I love that you have a 20-year vision.
Yeah, I mean, that's the theory, but like the reality is, you know, you live in, what's that thing that says we live in the detail, really, you know, so I have to kind of live day to day, you know.
Yeah.
Which is like much more, we need to, you know, invest in company X, we need to raise this much LP money, but but always keep at the back of my mind, like how we want to do that bigger vision.
So tell the founders out there, if they wanted to, you know, they like your vibe, and they're like, maybe we should approach Khaled. And
they really like my vibe. They like the team's vibe, but me, they really like me very much. But, yeah.
But if they wanted to approach Nua, give us, first of all, really quickly, what is it that you're currently looking for? So it sounds like you're really still focused on seed, or
Yeah.
So really early stage. Are you sector agnostic?
Yes, we're sector agnostic. We're really on the early stage, we're really looking at like great founders that are really focused on solving for big problems. And I think more and more of those problems tend to be localized issues. Mm. It used to be much more adapting global business models for local consumption, but I think that's shifting very rapidly.
Now it's more ideas born to some very local issues.
Yeah,
that might be using sort of global tech and whatnot.
Exactly. Yeah. So. And I think we like, I don't know how to articulate, we should kind of think about how to articulate this better, but second order effect companies or derivative companies, meaning BNPL now is big, right? For example, like you've got Tamara, you've got Tabby, we want to invest in companies that serve the explosion in consumer credit that the advent of those types of businesses has heralded. You right. see what I mean?
Like, the next stage.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what? The value what, chain.
Exactly. Yeah. So capital markets, for example, Tadawul in Saudi is growing very quickly in terms of market cap and volume and velocity. So is the DFM and the Abu Dhabi Exchange. What are businesses that serve capital markets, for example? So that's, we really like that. SaaS is shifting globally. We have a lot, we're looking at a deal now. We haven't closed yet, but hopefully by end of the day, we'll sign it. Arnav, who's on our team, he's supposed to kind of close it today. So I'm going to call him right after to be like, I'm closed. It's like, you know, thinking about SaaS, the impact of like niche SaaS globally and how to kind of work around that.
Yeah.
And what AI will mean for it. So it's a business that brings all these things together, which is derivative of multiple aspects of the tech ecosystem. And so we, so that's the kind of businesses we want to invest in. Like those that grow out of second order effects.
Okay. Beautiful. And geography, you mentioned you are focused on Saudi, but is it MENA? It's generally
a core part of our thesis is companies that are solving region wide, because that's how you get to kind of large economic scale. Because individually, the countries are not so large, except for Saudi, maybe. But still, to get to a big outcome, you need like 3, 4, 5 markets.
Okay, beautiful.
Turkey included is a big focus.
Turkey included. Yeah. Okay, Pakistan.
We do, but I think some macro issues there. Yeah. So until that's resolved, I think we're
same with Egypt out. To some extent, right?
To some extent, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So I'm a founder. I want to come and ask you a Nua Capital for funding. Tell me and hundreds of me out there, what makes a perfect pitch to you?
Good question. So I think, one, very clear articulation of the problem straight up, right? Like this is, you know, and that anybody can appreciate or quickly appreciate within like 3, 4 sentences, even if it's B2B or B2C. Sometimes the B2B companies find like, you know, go in a big circle around like, oh, we're solving this problem, but they can't really articulate it. B2C sometimes easier, but one, articulation of the problem straight up, very clear. How they're solving it, very clearly. And why this is a large market. So if you go 1, 2, 3, quickly to the point, I think that's the best hook at the beginning. I think that's always the best. You'd be surprised how many people get lost in the, initially in kind of talking about their product or talking about the market size. I mean, these are all important, but yeah. I think you first, this is, have you ever, you know, like we use the Uber example. Wasn't it annoying to have to pay for not finding a cab on the street and like, you know, not have the exact change, blah, blah, blah. I remember Mudassar pitched that like exactly like this. Like I was a consultant. I wouldn't have change, no the address. Wouldn't be great if I could just do it like this. Mm-hmm. And that's it. That's the very clear articulation of the problem and how we're solving it. Then you go into, you know, the market size actually huge. And this is how the product works. And this is our revenue model. This is sort of like a basically like concise, succinct, and orderly articulation of the opportunity. It's surprisingly sometimes like absent. But I don't think that the one other thing, the choreography of the pitch is marginal. It's like, yes, that helps, but it doesn't.
Doesn't move the needle.
Doesn't. Because eventually you get there, you know, eventually you'll get there. But it's marginal. Like, obviously, it helps to have a very well-constructed pitch. But it's on the margins. It's not going to make you a success or not. It actually speaks more about your other qualities. So if you're able to articulate an idea or concept as a founder or founding team well, that means it's an insight into how you, again, like, think about problems, how you will work with other stakeholders, whether that's clients or employees or shareholders. So you're looking for that. So if you're able to kind of present well and think through a problem and present how you're going to solve it well, that speaks to your quality overall as a founder. And that's kind of what, you know, looking at. I talk about second order effects, but that's the kind of like what we're looking at usually.
And when do you suggest a founder starts coming to VC? And I ask this because I know there's been quite a, well, there's a wide variety of approaches you can take, yeah, and it's changed and evolved over the years. There was a time where people really had to build businesses. It had to stick. It had to be somewhat profitable. Yeah. And then you went to, you know, other forms of financing to scale that. Now it seems like there's a lot of people that come up with a back of the napkin idea. They pull a team together and then they go get funding before they really start.
Yeah.
I'm curious what your thoughts are on that and what approach they should take. Like, how do they start looking, yeah, at who they talk to, in what order, how to find the right investors for their cap table?
Sure. I think like the asset class has really grown over the past 30 years. So you do have specialized investors that do like idea stage, pre-seed. You have some investors some programs that even focus like pre-idea. So, you know, if you want to be a founder, but you want to meet other founders, like Entrepreneur First, for example, do that. So I think there is an investor for each stage, and you just, as a founder, make sure that you're talking to you can talk to VCs as early as you want, but you want to make sure you're talking to the right investors that are relevant to your stage. And then second, relevant to your sector, have expertise in your sector, or have an understanding of that segment. So you can go as early as you want. I think the first ticket, you should always put your own money. I think that's super important. Put a little bit of your own cash in, plus family, friends, and others.
They should approach you, they should approach the right investors by stage,
mm-hmm,
also sector-specific, mm-hmm, background. What else?
Sector-specific, optional, but helpful. You know, because
I feel like that's what all VCs, yeah, say, because they want to be opportunistic.
Yeah, yeah.
But okay, put yourself in the founder's shoes. What is it like? I wish more founders knew that VC money isn't just capital. It's actually an opportunity to get really strategic value, advice, networks opening up.
Networks, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. What is it that you think different VCs can provide founders that they should be also looking at?
Yeah, I think like right now in the region, we're a moment where I think we're moving towards the VCs becoming more differentiated, but they're not there yet. We're all trying to kind of figure out our thing. Like for Nua, we're trying to be, you know, multi-stage, different kind of tailored capital for different stages, plus this value creation element. And then kind of opening up our networks, which are kind of Saudi focused or kind of multi-market. So, you know, how do we get Turkish companies to move here, for example? I think that's what we look at. Within the team, different people have different sets of expertise. So we cover a good variety of industries. I think eventually we'll have to kind of specialize. But for founders, I think you want to see if these VCs have done something similar or have an openness to kind of the sector or the segment. And you can see that from the portfolio, basically. And then I think the best thing is just other founder references. Call up their portfolio companies. What did you get out of XYZ? Was it, mm-hmm, good? Was it bad? Was it good experience, bad experience? There's always going to be someone who says, actually, it was terrible. But like, I think you want to kind of create your own view out of that.
And what is your personal biggest pet peeve of founders approaching you and asking for funding, or it's something they do in a pitch, or anything that really kind of goes, that really bothers me?
I'm trying to think of something that I'm not going to regret saying later. But I think one thing is like, it's happening less so, but used to happen a lot, I think, especially in the region, is that this is not a philanthropic exercise, right? Like this is a business. Like the VC is a business and the founder should be running a business. This is not like, not here to support and to help and to like, you know, this is like, you know, we'll invest if there's a viable business and you should be building a viable business. It's not, if you want to do impact in that sense, I think, you know, go elsewhere, basically, you know, like it's a different proposition. Sometimes, even though it's happening less so, there's a conflation of that. So you get founders say like, you know, I don't know if this problem I'm solving for is XYZ, but I'm actually like helping a social cause as part of that. And they focus 80% on the social cause. I was like, no. It's like, it's the other way around. The social cause, if you solve it, is a byproduct of the business, not the other way around. It's not And that kind of bothers me. It's like, because it's conflating like the wrong thing. You can solve huge social issues and have massive like impact by building great businesses, but the driver is the business, and then the impact is what comes with building a great business. Not, it doesn't happen in reverse.
I love that. And we're coming full circle to, you know, your childhood of some philosophical beliefs to really seeing what the benefits of capitalism is.
Yeah.
And really saying, hey, this business needs to be profitable.
Yeah.
And have the fundamentals in place in order for a broader mission, whether
exactly,
it's social
yeah.
good or environmental good, to really come into play.
Yeah, I think there is this, like, you know, by building a great business, solving a tangible problem with a product that people want and want to use, that could lead to like a big positive social impact, and that's good. That's like we want that, and to get make people's lives better. But you leading in reverse rarely works. Like I'm yet to see it. Like, you know, I'm sure there are great examples, but I've not seen it yet. So like.
Yeah, it's like those car chase scenes in a movie. A few people can drive in reverse in a high-speed car chase, but most people can't.
Yeah. No, I think like one good example I always give, like, even though it's tangential, is like aid agency, like aid money, for example.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you have these huge programs, like Jordan, for example, like we're talking about Jordan. Jordan is one of the largest per capita recipients of aid on the planet, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's number two for USAID, but even globally, it's like on a per capita basis huge. And I think so much of that capital goes towards, you know, designing programs that are, goes to people, you know, the people who work in the aid agencies who give, farm out that capital to people who design the aid programs, who in turn, you know, till it filters down to like building, we've decided that we need to build a solar panel farm in this rural village, etc. Actually, you know, you can disintermediate all of that and just give the $3-4 billion a year directly proportionally to the people, and it's much more effective, and you know, so much more effective, you know, but anyway, I'm going down a separate tangent, but I think it's in the spirit of this, like, you know, we think we're doing good, but actually, you know, build something that is useful for people, and then the impact will come with that.
Final words, Khaled, what final words do you have for entrepreneurs out there in this climate, for them to keep in mind, some words of advice?
So I think like right now, the most topical thing is that, you know, money is scarce, capital is scarce. I would say that it may appear that way, relatively so, but if you build a good business, there's always capital available. Always. It's just about building a great business. And keep in mind that over the next few years, I think there will be a shift towards much more capital efficiency. The focus on like really fundamentally building a good business that is driven by good unit economics, solving for a problem, and keep in mind that, you know, you might need to be a bit more efficient doing it. But if you get there, there's always capital for great founders building great businesses.
I love that. Thank you, Khaled.
No, thank you for having me. Thanks.
It's been wonderful.
Hope that was
have
useful.
You here. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Hey there. Thanks for joining this conversation. If you enjoyed that episode and you want to start researching potential investors for your startup's fundraising strategy, go to lucidityinsights.com and sign up now to the startup registration package by clicking the plans button on the top right corner. We look forward to having you join our future conversations and checking out our additional content. Until next time, stay hungry and stay humble.